This is Justin Abey from Pinnacle Community Capital Investments, and you're listening to the SME Podcast.
You are now listening to the next great small business podcast. Welcome to the SME Stories Podcast, where it is all about small businesses in Canada. And here's your host, Ken Alfred.
Hey, everybody, we got a great show today. We have Justin Abey from Pinnacle Community Capital Investments. So a little bit about Justin. Justin's roots in the real estate space run deep, as he comes from a family of architects and builders. He got his start in the field by working with his father and grandfather to flip dilapidated homes and construct new homes from scratch. Later on, Justin transitioned into a career of design where he actually worked as a furniture and lighting designer, design engineer, project manager in architectural projects, and the director of product development for a home goods company. Throughout his career, Justin developed critical skills in contract negotiation, estimation, project management, vendor management, personal management, and design. Despite his successful career in design, Justin continued to pursue his passion of real estate on the side. 2 years ago, he took the lead into multifamily real estate, making it his full-time career. So guys, we're going to be talking about real estate investment on this episode, specifically talking about multifamilies. So I think that's going to be a great topic that we're going to talk about, and sit back and absorb. So the next question I got for you here is, like, what are the key elements in your opinion? Like, what should be the first thing that a new real estate investor or whatever, how should they analyze the deal? What should they be looking for?
Yeah. So a big part of what we do is as far as our due diligence for projects is, one, we're looking at the metro that we want to invest in. So we do a heavy amount of market research into the metro areas or the MSAs that we're looking at. And we're looking for job growth. We're looking for population growth. We're looking for number of families that are growing. We're looking at the average median income. We're looking at all these parameters that say, yeah, we want to be investing in here because we see that the population is growing. People are moving here. The wages are growing. There's a lot of investment through big companies going in, whether it's an Amazon distribution center or a data center or a new plant going in or a port or military or anything like that. Right. That's sort of paramount. We need to make sure that everything's growing, and that's really where we see the growth of our properties, right? Mm-hmm. And then secondly, you know, you really have to do the due diligence into the property itself, right? You need to check all the boxes, look at the current rents, and making sure that the seller is telling the truth, generally they're not, and you want to get down to the truth and see all the details of the property. Go in and actually walk the property and do your due diligence there by looking for looking at the conditions of the units and the condition of the property and looking for things like the major systems, electrical, plumbing, HVAC, and seeing what sort of, and the roofs and drainage, and making sure all of those things are what they say they are on paper.
Right.
And that you're not getting caught off guard by anything like that. Right. That's
right.
So those are the big ticket items that really, make a difference.
Yeah. Cause if you're looking at a prospectus and what a lot of, you know, sellers try to put, they put a perspective of, here's how much you can kind of generate, here much rents are, here's how much profit we got, and, you know, buy this. And that's why you're buying a cash flowing property, right? And your job is to reevaluate that to find out, right? Because for some reason, if you're looking at a unit that says, yep, this is 1500 square feet, you walk it and it's like 1000 square feet, and you're like, okay,
a little smaller than wrong. What you said. Yeah.
Yeah. So what else did they get wrong? Right. Because, you know, they could put almost anything in there because they're trying to literally unload it, right? So
yeah, and you'll see on the prospectus that these brokers put together, you know, they'll put a in-place cap rate, and then they'll put a pro forma cap rate, and they're trying to paint this picture of like, here's the potential of this property, right? And so what they're looking for are people overpaying and looking, oh, well, we can pay this much because this is what it could perform at. But really what you want to look at is what it's performing at right now. Because as I mentioned, it's valued at the net operating income that's currently in place, right? And so we're not going to pay more for a property just because it could make more money. We need to make sure that it is making that much money, right? So exactly. That's another tip. Never trust a pro forma cap rate on one of these prospectuses.
Perfect. And just explain to the listeners, just in case, if some of them are new to this one, what's a cap rate and how why is that important?
So a cap rate is the measure of a return if you were to pay all cash for a property, right? And so generally, within the last few years, we've been looking at 4.5 to 5.5, maybe 6% cap rate. So that would be if you bought that property for all cash, you're going to cash flow 6%. But we're working with banks and leveraging the debt, and so the returns are much better than what the cap rate suggests, right? But that's just a good way of rating what a property is bringing in cash flow wise.
Right. So if you see a cap rate of 35%, you might have to do a little bit digging on that one, because you're saying why? If it's too good to be true.
Exactly. It probably is.
So another question one of my listeners had here is, I found a deal. I don't know if I can secure any funding to it, like let's say the banks or the credit unions. How else can I, what are some other strategies that I can do? I've heard of, I guess, creative financing, but in your opinion, Justin, when does creative financing be very applicable to a deal, and when should it not be applicable for a deal, in terms of what are certain deals that maybe it might not be the best one for?
Yeah. So in the world of single family, there's a lot more creative finance elements that you can leverage. But in the world of multifamily, there are still some. When you're approaching on a smaller deal, a mom and pop operation where they've owned it for generations, the best creative finance opportunity you will see is seller finance. And that is not dealing with banks, not qualifying at all. You are essentially saying to the buyer, I want you to become the bank in this situation. And you lay out the parameters of the deal, whether it's no money down or 10% down or 20% down. And then you pay a payment to them every month. And the terms are endless, right? It just depends on what they're comfortable with and what you're comfortable with, what you underwrite and what works for the deal, right? And so there's some really great opportunities on those smaller deals to utilize that. You can also utilize the loan assumption in multifamily, which is essentially like taking over someone's mortgage payments. The bank has to approve of it. And generally documented in the signing of the original loan that it is assumable in the future. But you can get some really great interest rates under assumed mortgages back, 2019 to 2021, when we're seeing, 3 to 5%. So you can assume that mortgage payment to the bank, and then you'll have to either work out a deal with the seller, whether that's a seller carryback or a seller finance on their equity of the loan. And so those are probably the two best avenues of creative finance in multifamily. Of course, the sky's the limit. It just depends on what you can talk the seller into and what's allowed by the banks or so on.
So can you use seller financing on a property that still has a loan or mortgage on it? Or is it only, because I understood my limited knowledge with it is that, okay, if the owners already own the property free and clear, mm-hmm. easy option you can work with, right? Because, okay, we'll work. Totally. Or we can work something out. But if they're, let's say you have this mom and pop shop, but they still have a few years left of payments on it, but they want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right. And, like you said, you're struggling with a bank. Can that work still?
Yeah.
Or would it be very, so
that, okay. that was the, you know, loan assumption.
Okay.
Or in the case of smaller assets, it might be a subject to, and then the seller would take a second position on the note. And they would carry, they would have what's called a seller carry back, which means that you're making two separate payments. You're making a payment to the bank and you're making a payment to the original seller.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So, what should my next question for one of my listeners here, what should be my ideal occupancy rate when investing into a multifamily? And occupancy rate, and just for the listeners, if you can explain, it's kind of like the number of units that you have. What's Correct. The percentage of it? So if you have a 5-unit apartment, you have 4 units that are occupied, that's about 80% occupancy rate, right?
Right.
So if someone's looking into a multifamily, what should be something that they'd be looking at? Do they really want something with like zero occupancy rate, or do they want something with like a little bit? What's your opinion on that?
Well, it really depends on the investor. Some people love to have a apartment building that is free and clear, and they want to put their tenants in, or they want to go in and they want to remodel it from head to toe right away, right? And increase their rents and up to market rates. Maybe they're a general contractor and they have a team and they can knock it out really fast, and they love to have zero occupancy and they have the cash to carry the property and know that it's going to pay off in 6 months to a year after this whole thing's been remodeled, right? There are people who look for low occupancy because they see it as an opportunity. But in the world of syndication, if you're going to get bank financing, especially from the big two, Fannie and Freddie, who offer some really great loans, because you're essentially incentivized to give people a place to live. They are contracted by the government to provide great loan terms, but they're looking for a stabilized asset and they're looking for generally 90% occupancy or higher, 85 sometimes, right? And so it really depends on the size of the deal, the type of financing that you're looking for, the available cash on hand, and what you're expecting in the lift, right? So you might be okay with a heavy lift, or you might be wanting to have some cash flow right off the bat, and you're just going to improve units as people leave and you turn over the units, or you make you remodel it fully to get, you know, the highest market rents.
Okay. All right. So we got another listener question here. So if this is, let's say, my first deal and I'm really new, but, you know, I can't afford a property management company to manage my units. And, you know, is there any tips that I should, you know, can do that can help save me some money if I'm going to be managing a unit myself?
I would say get a property management company.
That's
my tip. I mean, you trade your time for money, right? And the management of a property, while you might save some money, your time is going to be tied up with late night calls of a toilet clogged up or a heater not working. Or, you know, visits to the property to sign leases or so on, where you could be working towards that next deal and not worrying about the day to day. We love to put property management in place. I would say if you're looking at a 4-unit, 8-unit, 10-unit, something like that, you know, generally, you're going to have a hard time maybe finding a property management at an affordable cost. And so I think you just need to expect that you're going to get a lot of those calls, and a lot of your time is going to be tied up. But that your next deal, you plan on having a property management company. I mean, you know, it's just the stair step. Yeah. And I think doing your due diligence on your tenants is paramount, right? Especially if you live in states that have tenant laws that benefit the tenant a lot more than the landlord, right? And evictions are a challenge. So
yeah,
you want to make sure that you're doing background checks on them, you're doing employment verification, that you're looking at their finances to make sure that they can afford the apartment, and really just putting the rules in place that are going to protect you as a landlord. So
yeah,
that might be, you know, no smoking or no pets or, you know, no extra people living with you without approval or, you know, some of those things, right?
That are going to be, you can't sublease your apartment to someone else or you need someone else.
Right.
Because I know here in Canada, it's very heavy on more for the tenant versus the landlord. So sometimes it's really tough. And unfortunately, your heart breaks for some of the landlords, because I guess when some people think of landlords, they think of the, you know, oh, those people that are burning $100 bills smoking a cigar. When right. I think I think the majority of landlords are probably just like your mom and pop that just wanted to put a little investment in. And
it's their retirement that they're banking on. Yeah. And, you know, you have to have compassion for your tenants. Of course, we want to be good landlords. We want to give them a safe place to live and them to have a pride of place. But the tenant is also expected to pay their living
promptly. Costs. Yeah.
And we try to work with tenants when they get into issues and try to give them some grace if possible, and mm-hmm. give them the resources that they might need to make ends meet. But, you know, ultimately on some of these small mom and pops, you're prolonging someone's retirement, by, you know, taking advantage of them. And so, I think landlords do get a bad rap, and especially the ones like us that are really trying to give place, you know, a good place to live for people.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing too, right? Because, you know, I've heard of some, you know, that whole, the term cash for keys, right? And that's basically where for some reason that you're just offering your tenant money just to leave. And mm-hmm. some tenants I've heard of here in Canada where they're asking for, okay, I want $100,000 to leave, or you got to find a place and put me there for right. it. Because they, right. and remember, these tenants are not paying any rent, like they're withholding their rent from it. And to try to get the landlord tenant board here in Canada or Ontario, where I live, the state, the province that I live in, it's really hard for it. And I think I had a realtor on before who also manages her own properties. She's like, documentation is the key. You have to be ready for it, because if you, God forbid, you hit a professional tenant, the ones who will stretch it out for as long as they can, or they'll ask you for the $100,000 to leave. It's, you know, if you have your things documented, you're pretty much good that you'll win in that perspective. So that's really good. So let's go back to property management companies there. What are the red flags for a property management company that you might end up seeing?
Well, you want to get references for sure. You want to talk to those other operators that are using them, because, you know, property management companies can be all talk and no action sometimes. You want to make sure that they have the proper processes and procedures in place to protect you as a landlord, to protect your property, to give you the right to take action when necessary. And that they, you know, they're doing their due diligence on your tenants, and that they have a great response rate on any tenant issues, like a leaky faucet or a clogged toilet or, you know, a heater that's gone out. We don't want anybody languishing for long in mm-hmm. in the necessities that they need. And so we want to make sure that their response rate is really good, and that they have a process in place to respond quickly to those requests from the tenants. And just making sure that you like the company and their ethos and your regional property manager, and that you feel like you can work with them and accomplish something together.
And do you go with more of a bigger player? Do you want to go with a smaller player? And I guess the second follow-up question that my listener had as well is that, should it be a flat fee or should it be a percentage of rent in terms of best practices that as you would do?
We're usually looking at a percentage of income. Sorry, can you repeat the question one more time?
First part of the question is, should we go with more of a bigger property management company or a smaller one?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the percentage rent versus flat fee of them managing your property.
I think it really depends on how well that they've scaled into a large company, right? This goes for anything like mentorships or property management or, services that you're garnering from someone. They might have great processes and procedures, and therefore you can go with a larger company. And that really comes down to your due diligence and making sure that you're talking to people that are using them. The syndication realm is not a huge network. And so we know a lot of people and what property managers that are using and can go and talk to some of our friends and colleagues and say, hey, we're looking in this area. Who are you using and are you happy with them? Right. You might find a smaller company that is hungry and is going to go above and beyond for you. Much more than a larger company would. Right. And so it really, it's trusting your gut and seeing who really wants the job the most and who has their stuff together to do what you want, because it is really, they become part of the team. We hire them, but they become part of the team. They're on our weekly asset management calls and they give updates and we get to know them really personally and know their families and so on. And so, you want someone that you can work with and feel comfortable with.
Excellent. All right. I got a few more questions, man. This is the longest Tips from the Pro segment I think we've ever had, which is really a good problem to have. So next question here is, okay, what are your best practices to not over renovate a unit?
Yeah. So that's a great question. We, in our due diligence, we're looking at rental comps, right? We're looking at the apartment down the street or within a mile radius or a 3 mile radius or 5 mile radius. And we do site visits. We go and look at their apartments and really trying to understand the position of our property in comparison to what else is in the area. Right. And so, we go out and we look and see that their premium units have granite and stainless steel and washers and dryers and they're a solid B class asset. We know that we need to renovate to that level, right? Because we're trying to compete with them. Whereas if we go out and we see that they only have linoleum countertops and they haven't
white stoves.
They haven't updated their appliances and they don't have in-house washers and dryers, but they have a laundry facility, then we're not going to go to those levels. But we also may see a path of progress and saying this area is really growing. There's a lot of people moving in. They don't have those, but we feel like we can capture extra additional rent because there's not that product on the market. And so it's really asset to asset and knowing the area that you're investing in and knowing where it's going and where it's been.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, because I think some people make the mistake, especially if they watch a lot of those fix and flip shows or those home reno shows, they just like, oh, we got to
put the make everything things beautiful. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we want to make things beautiful, but at an affordable price.
Exactly. Unless there's a certain number of units you're going to designate as a premium unit. And that's the thing that most people don't know is that they think, oh, apartment units, they have to be all looking the same.
Right.
To an extent, right? But you might, like you just mentioned, that if you have a lot of units, you might designate, okay, we're going to have maybe 10 premium units on this particular location, or we might just have 5. So it's not like going to be, all right, good, better, best kind of thing that you're going to have. But at the end of the day, your properties are safe and they meet the demand of what's currently out there. So that's really good.
And here's another tip is that if you plan on selling that asset in 2, 3, 5, 10 years, you don't want to renovate the entire thing. You want to leave some of them unrenovated to leave some meat on the bone for the next investor.
Oh. Because
that's how they grow the forced appreciation of the property, right? So
right.
We have an asset right now that we have an office in one of the units, and we've been talking about whether we build a whole new office building or we leave that for the next investor, right? They can come in and renovate and get the new rents on that one unit that's now an office but could be an apartment building.
Wow. That's a great tip, actually.
Yeah.
All right. So last two questions, I promise. Last two questions on the tips and the pro, and then we'll get to the fun stuff here. So I've heard, and this is one of my listeners here, have you ever contemplated utilizing units in your properties to designate them as an Airbnb?
Yes. Yes, we have. We have thought about that. There are actually a lot of Airbnb operators that will come in and operate an Airbnb and pay you extra rent. That is generally, you're looking at A class, B class assets.
I was going to say, yeah, because I mean that the idea of Airbnb seems good from the general perspective, but I guess it depends literally on your location. Are you near, you know, in Canada, are we near a ski resort?
Absolutely.
Okay. Then you might have a little bit better opportunity than if you're in
a town center or
a sports
facility or anything like that, or a hospital or anything like that. Yeah. The other thing you have to watch in larger syndications is that the banks don't love you putting a ton of those units in because it's a risk in their eyes. So you can operate a few of those in larger deals, but
just don't make it a big part of your portfolio though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's a great way to push your net operating income for sure.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, right? Because especially, you know, the idea of like, okay, we're working on this unit and it looks pretty good. And, you know, let's just rent it out for a little bit as an Airbnb if you're having trouble finding a good tenant pool for that. So,
right.
All right. Last question on this one here. What is your work-life balance? What are your best recommendations for work-life balance when you're getting into the multifamily investment space?
Well, you're becoming your own boss, so you have to be a self-starter. But you know, going from a full-time W-2 job to full-time investing has been tremendous for my work-life balance, because I can pick the times that I want to work, and I can, you know, spend the time right after school with my children, for a few hours doing, you know, being fun dad and take them to school and pick them up if I need to, or escape for, you know, a week or a long weekend or whatever. But you got to make sure that you stay focused. And so a lot of that is goal setting. A lot of that is time blocking. A lot of that is self-starting. I think it's just really important to stay focused.
All right. And last question on this one, would you bring your kids into the business?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm in the process of writing a course teaching children and families how to invest. And also I will be releasing a course here soon about how to invest passively in multifamily apartment buildings. But going back to the family investment, it's, you know, it's something that's not taught in school. And it's for a reason. They want us in W-2 jobs. They want us working for other people and being part of the cog, right? And I think it's huge if you can teach your children how to invest and how to start early and whether they want to start a business or they want to invest in real estate or they, you know, want to invest in other assets, but teaching them the fundamentals of saving money, giving money to charity, spending money in what proportion, right? So that's a big part of what I'm trying to teach my children, is that, you know, we give them an allowance and you know, they need to put a third of it into their spending account, a third of it into their investing account, and then a third into their philanthropy. That and we really try to instill that into our children, and even want to expand that in the future into possibly having some nonprofit curriculum around that that goes into schools and teaches children how to manage their finances.
Wow, that's great. I mean, yeah. Let us know. Let me know when that book's come out, and we'll definitely put in the show notes. We'll have it the listeners come look at that, because I think that's a really good thing to have. So,
awesome.
Hey, you, do you need a voiceover? Well, look no farther. Northway Capital Group has your answer. Commercials and explainer videos, AVR and voicemail, health and wellness, corporate training and e-learning, announcements, documentaries, and biography. Contact us on social media or email us at northwaycapitalgroup@gmail.com. Now it's time for the rapid fire round.
Thank you.
All right. Now we're going to do the rapid fire round now. Ready? So this is going to be the fun stuff that, you know what, we talked a lot of serious stuff. So let's have some fun with this one.
Yeah.
All right. So question number one there, Justin, what would the 15-year-old self be thinking you'd be doing right now?
Oh man. Probably, playing major league sports. That's what I wanted to do. Yeah. I wanted to be a pitcher in baseball or a soccer star or something like that. You know, the
professional athlete.
Yeah. The professional athlete, but you know, life gets in the way.
You can always put professional investor on your business card if you really want. Yeah. So you are a professional. So,
yeah.
All right. Question number two, what is something you hate you wish you actually loved?
Something that I hate that I wish I actually loved.
And it could be something that your kids really love or your spouse really loves, but for some reason you just don't like it. Or your friends really love this thing, whether it's a TV show or a particular food or something. Like my wife's thing, she loves playing Wordle. I still don't get it. My kids love it. I don't get it.
Yeah.
My wife and kids, they love durian fruit. I don't know if you ever had durian before.
I have had durian.
Yeah. I can't do it. I've tried it two or three times. I can't love it. But what about you?
Gin cocktails.
Gin cocktails.
Yeah.
Not a fan.
I'm a bourbon man, and I have tried gin over the years. People swear by it. They try to sell me on it. I taste it and I'm always like, yeah, it just tastes like pine salt to me. And I know there are better gins out there, or some that don't taste like pine, but I still can't get one.
Yes. Well, any of my listeners who have a gin company, if you really think Justin, if you want to prove Justin wrong, by all means, let me know. We can send one him to him.
Send me a bottle. I'm willing. I have an open mind.
There we go. All right. What is your guilty pleasure or/slash biggest time waster?
Yeah, I guess it would be, I love surfing. That's how I clear my head. I have to, you know, it takes a lot of time to go out and sit in the water and wait for waves and all that. It's a guilty pleasure. It's probably, I could spend my time doing other things, but it really, you know, it helps to center me and keep me focused. And I always feel like I come away feeling better.
You can't really say that's a time that's not a time waster. I mean, like, it's actually benefiting you, so I can't imagine that would be it. But I would think it's
like, a time waster, I guess.
Yeah. What'd you say the last one?
I said some people see it as a time waster. My wife probably sees it as a time waster.
I thought people would say, like, oh, okay, something on Netflix or
to decompress at the end of the evening, we enjoy our Netflix for sure, or a good scroll through Instagram or something like that.
Yeah, like mindless scrolling is something I'm trying to get away from because it never ends. So I find if I want to decompress and watch something that doesn't involve my brain, I'll just go on YouTube and watch really silly things that just so happens that you don't need to think too much about it. Like, I saw this one video. It was literally a groundhog eating vegetables in front of a camera. All it is, different vegetables. Yeah. And the groundhog knows exactly where this camera is.
Yeah. Or I think someone, I've seen that one. Yeah, it's hilarious. Yeah.
Or someone pressure washing something that's
funny. Or the cute bunny.
Yeah. or maybe watching some pressure washing of something that's really dirty and now it's clean. You're just there. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Just makes me feel better. I'm not thinking of it. I'm not learning anything.
Visually but it's like, stimulating and satisfying.
Yeah. Just to ease your mind if you don't want to see something. All right. Like last two questions here. I always ask all my guests here. What, if you could create your own sandwich, what would be on it and what would you call it?
I could create my own sandwich. Oh man. That's not in creation already.
That's freestyle. It doesn't matter. Name whatever you want.
And these are hard. These are the hard hitting questions that everyone wants to know.
What's Justin's sandwich? Tell us, Justin.
Yeah. I love Reuben sandwiches. So probably, Reuben with Gouda cheese.
Oh, Gouda's nice.
And some spicy element. You know, I love spice, so maybe it might be jalapenos or ghost peppers or some sort of spicy sauce or something like that.
Nice. And sorry, what kind of bun would you use for that?
I'd probably use a sourdough.
Oh, sourdough is nice.
Yeah.
And what would you call it?
I don't know. That's a good one. What do you think I should call it?
I don't know. You can name it after your company, something Pinnacle.
Yeah. Pinnacle Pickles Spicy there, Reuben.
There you go. Put it on a shirt. Well, you know what? That's not a bad response there, Justin, because I've had other guests where it was really hard. And you know who struggled with that question the most? Chefs.
Oh, really?
they just overthink it.
Yeah.
They cannot come up, you know, because I even threw another monkey wrench at some chefs where I said, okay, cereal, is it soup? Why or why not? Their minds would just explode because they're one that said, well, no, it's not a soup. Soup can't be cold. Oh, wait, no, soup can gazpacho be cold. Is. Yeah, gazpacho, like soup can be cold. No, they would, I'm like, guys, it's called the rapid fire round. Now we're up to 20 minutes. You're talking about a sandwich. So don't need to worry about it.
All right. Love it.
These are and great. The last question here is, what is your theme song and why? So you're walking down the street, that song hits. Everyone knows Justin's coming.
I don't know. It'd probably be something funky or something like that. I don't know. The Bee Gees, Staying Alive.
There you go. Love that song. Love the song. So, all right. So now we're wrapping up here, Justin. Look at this. It's been over an hour. This thing flew by really fast, always do. So what would be your last piece of advice for anyone, whether it's wanting to get in the real estate space or just really starting their own business? What's your best piece of advice you can give them?
Start now. Don't wait. Get going. It's never too late. We talk to people all the time. It's like they're in their 50s or 60s and they're like, well, you know, I've worked my whole life. I just have a little bit of retirement savings, 401ks, which we can invest into multifamily. But they get stuck. They get stuck. And then also just take action. I think everyone gets into this analysis paralysis and they, you know, the best way to learn is just to get in there and do it and fail forward. Right. You're gonna hit those roadblocks, but it's the creative ways that you solve those. Being a this capability and it's how you solve those person and on top is
character. Exactly. And don't even, and for those who are getting into real estate, you don't have to put your entire life savings into one big deal.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with deals or anything like that. Or maybe just work. You can information for Pinnacle Community Corporation. You can maybe work with Justin and maybe he can kind of show you the ropes of how. Absolutely. So where can people reach out to you, Justin?
Yeah. Yeah. So our website is pin-cap.com. And I'm on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, all the things. So you can search us up there, or you can just go to our website and our social media handles are linked on our website. So www.pin-cap.com.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Justin, for being on the show.
It was awesome. Great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Hey, do you need an error-free website? Do you need transcription that's accurate and on time? Would you like to remove noise from your video or audio recording? Do you need a spokesperson for your business? If so, we can help. At Northway Capital Group, we are happy to announce that we are now providing website testing services, audio transcriptions, and audio cleanup, as well as spokesperson services. We would love to help you on your next project. Contact us for more information at northwaycapitalgroup@gmail.com.
Thank you for listening to the SME Stories podcast, which is owned by Northway Capital Group. Please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Northway Capital Group.